HPPodCraft.com.
Howdy, folks, and welcome to the comments show for July on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Last month was a potpourri of stories, and you all had some excellent insights, as always, so let's dig in.
Right on. First up, we have Sticks, the story Sticks, speaking of digging in. You know, I posted an image of a bundle of sticks on social media when we released that episode, and a listener on Instagram, he was looking out for us, wrote in and said, hey, you might want to be careful because the bundle of sticks image was a symbol for fascism.
Oh, my God.
When that was kicking off. And most of those like Italian fascist symbols are based on that bundle of rods.
What?
I was like, hey,
where did that come from?
I was referencing Aesop's Fables, which says, you know, my sons, do you not see how certain it is that if you agree with each other and help each other, it will be impossible for your enemies to injure you? But if you are divided among yourselves, you will be no stronger than a single stick in that bundle. There's no reference to that in the story, which is a Blair Witch thing. But I thought, congratulating myself in these difficult times, I'll put up this image of a bundle of sticks. And right away he was like, that's fascist. I couldn't find a more 2020, you know, thing to happen. Anyway, but I thought I'd leave the image up. I think they're actually, the fascists were going for the same thing, saying let's all bind together. But I think...
Yeah, but for evil.
If you're a stick that goes stray, we will break you.
You know? Oh, geez.
But I thought I'd leave that image up and see whether we accidentally radicalized anybody, and I don't think we did. Strangely, most of the likes for that image actually came from our dog listenership. So,
oh, of course.
Yeah, and I don't think they were reading too far into it.
No, then. They just like sticks.
They thought they were chasing it, and they accidentally hit the like button.
So Matt writes in about sticks. Someone tell that captain from the Pitch Black Manor song that laughing and mumbling about lost loves is not the accepted protocol when one ship is going down. I don't care if there's an unnameable whore involved or not. You've got to at least make a note in the captain's log. Keep flouting maritime procedures and pretty soon, pirates. Is that what you want, Captain? Pirates?
Whoa, I didn't even think of the pirate danger.
Oh, yeah.
Sheesh. Well, the Pitch Black Manor album Monster Classics drops this Friday, July 31st. When you buy a copy on Bandcamp, you also get the exclusive ability to warn our song characters about things. So... if you grab yours, we'll be able to pass the message along to the captain in that song.
Wow.
So go get it.
That's amazing. So after the song ends, he would be like, oh, shoot, I better do this thing.
Yeah.
That's great.
So if there's a song sequel, it will have incorporated your comments.
That's amazing.
Technology. Daniel Weber writes, thanks for another excellent episode. Enjoyed this one. Oh. I was thinking lich was an oldie-timey word for corpse, mostly based on lich yard as a synonym for graveyard. There's apparently a reference to lich yard in a poem from 1893, but a lot of the internet results for the word reference is its use in Game of Thrones. Yeah, that's right. It got used to Game of Thrones.
Sanjay Matthew writes, lich is indeed an oldie-timey word from English lich for corpse. Anglican churches sometimes have a roofed gate known as a lich gate. The first part of a funeral service was conducted at the gate, and so the roof was meant to protect the priests and mourners from the elements. Lich gate would make a pretty good band name, in my opinion.
It would, but people would think it's referencing some scandal. You know. Danielle writes, the lich gate or lich gate was an entrance to a cemetery. Lich with a Y or lich with an I is an old English Saxon word for corpse. Like you said, Clark Ashton... that hoary old wizard of Hyperborea, Clark Ashton Smith, seems to be the first or one of the early people to use it to mean an undead wizard. But even Lovecraft himself used the term in The Thing on the Doorstep. I will not change souls with that bullet-ridden lich in the madhouse.
Oh, that's
right. That was written in 1933, but not published until 37.
Good recall, Danielle. Wow.
Yes.
Shoggoth Lord writes, so far as I know, the folkloric origin of the term lich simply denoted a modal corpse. AD&D codified the modern concept of the lich as an undead spellcaster that has attained undeath by anchoring their soul to an object, called a phylactery. But as you noted, it was published concurrently with this tale, not before it was written. Lest I be mistaken, it's actually in Clark Ashton Smith's fiction that you first find lich used to describe an undead magician. I may be wrong, but I think it happens in The Return of the Sorcerer. From what I remember, Smith was using it in the generic sense of an undead, and it just happened to be an undead spellcaster. But hey, it seems to have caught on, hasn't it? Also, side note, this episode taught me that I reflexively cringe when I hear someone pronounce Wagner, and not Wagner.
Boy, we did that. We pronounced Wagner Wagner once, and I thought we'd murdered a priest or something. People were so upset about it.
But he's an American, so isn't his name pronounced Wagner? It's not Wagner.
Oh, yeah, the character in here was Wagner. Stacey Schumacher writes, the discussion on what seeing a non-purposeful symbol somewhere remote can trigger in your mind was relatable. Years ago, I was doing plant studies in a remote part of Scotland. I spent most of my days looking at the ground, but at one point, as I was in a small woodland, I glanced up to see a dead crow hanging from a string only a few feet away. That primitive brain thing kicked right in because I had no idea why what I was seeing could be. The bird was not tangled at all. It was clearly done deliberately, as if a symbol or totem. And despite having permission to be there, I got the hell out of there as fast as I could. When I told the person I worked for, a local, he chuckled and said that some farmers will place dead crows as a warning to other crows to stay away from the area. So a message of sorts, but felt very primitive and totemic. Oh. On a more pleasant note, the fight with the frying pan had me picturing the protagonist as Sam from Lord of the Rings. Made the heart scene even weirder, I can tell you. Yeah, I imagine.
Oh man, you know what's really funny is when I first read that, I thought it said a dead cow.
That's what I thought too when I read it. I don't know why. There's not a typo.
It's not a typo. I thought dead cow. I read the whole thing. I'm like, he hung up a dead cow and other cows are scared of dead cows?
Oh.
That's weird. I never, but it totally says multiple times crow. But for some reason, I was reading cow. I have no idea why.
Well, I read cow the first time and thought this must not be it. But I wish I had that misunderstanding the whole time because I like the scenario. That's almost like a Far Side scenario or something. Stringing up a cow to scare off other cows. Like,
oh, man.
But do you think that works with the crows?
Well, crows are really smart and they recognize faces and of people. So like if you're mean to a crow, they'll remember you're mean to the crow, to the, all the crows. They somehow communicate like that guy's a jerk.
So they'll be able to see a dead crow and go, that crow did not die by any natural means.
Maybe.
I'm not saying they can't.
Or maybe they saw a person hang it up and were like, oh, geez, that's brutal. Let's not hang around here.
So there's a couple storyteller crows who are letting everybody in on the...
There has to be, because crows somehow communicate. There was a whole bunch of experiments that were done with this, where this guy would wear a specific rubber mask and go out and pester crows or throw things at them or bother them. And then anytime somebody else put that mask on, the crows would go nuts and they would like start going after the guy and making a bunch of noise and or whoever was wearing that mask, because they recognized that was the person. And somehow if he was just mean to one crow, all the other crows would know that that dude was the one that was being mean to them.
Man, so you're saying I could just totally trash someone's reputation in the crow community if I had a mask made of them?
Yes.
I don't know. Everywhere I'm going, these crows are freaking out. I don't know what it is. Also, why do you have a Brendan mask? This is Brendan asking me that. I don't know, dude.
One passionate advocate for cat-based space travel, or CBST, wrote, long-time listener, first time.
Not the only one.
Long-time listener, first-time poster. While Kennedy did have a secretary named Evelyn Lincoln, none of Lincolns were named Kennedy. It is true they were both sorcerers, though, which is always left out of the history books. Yep, good point.
Yeah, that seems like the more interesting fact.
Yeah.
So that's not true, the secretary thing?
No.
That everybody says?
No. I've heard that wrong. Drix writes, hey guys, really like this show. Styx is definitely a badass story. On a barely related note, I was listening to your second strategies episode and realized the power of curse you guys have is still in full swing. Chad and Chris, this is what we said, you have to wear a mask for 6 months out of the year. What kind of mask do you wear? Oh,
man,
no.
That was one of our questions, wasn't it?
Oh, geez. Too brutal, says Drix. I am personally rocking a metal shirt I have turned into a bandana. It was its time. It had to be cut off me after I broke my arm skating. Awesome. And was wondering if you guys opted for the classic sick mask or something a little more improvised.
I have a standard red mask I've been wearing. Although Heather did get me a cool Darth Vader one that I'll...
My wife has a friend that got into the mask making scheme, you know, after she was furloughed. So she started making masks for everybody and we ordered one from her. It's got three layers, all that business, really nice. And mine is a Marvel Comics one, classic Buscema. It's got Thor, Iron Man, Captain America on there.
I wonder if I had glimpsed this future when I was a 12-year-old, would I have thought Cobra had taken over?
Oh my God. I think
about it all the time when I put that face mask on. I look like a Cobra soldier.
Rachel just got a blue one and it's made, and that's when I looked at her. I just immediately thought she looked like a Cobra agent. She just needs a helmet.
It's interesting how quickly it's not surreal, though, when I go out to the store and everybody's wearing the masks and stuff.
People adjust fast.
This is what it is now. I mean, it's depressing, but I just kind of forget about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go about your business. Now, lots of folks wrote in to let us know that we kind of missed the whole inspiration for this story. Styx. Our friends at Fadogan and Bremer wrote, I just listened to the episode about Carl Edward Wagner's story, Styx. Oh, I was saying the character's name, Wagner. Sorry, that's the author. But I thought I would share this with you, says the comment. It is the article that Lee Brown Coy wrote about his experience finding strange stick figures while out trout fishing. It was published in his local newspaper in the early 1960s. Lee and Carl were good friends, and Carl based the story on Lee and his experience. Whether Lee's story is true or not, we may never know, but it is fascinating nonetheless. And forwarded the article, but a few other people dropped sections from that article in the comments.
William Ryder wrote in, this is him quoting it, "As near as I can recollect, it must have happened in the spring of 1938. I was trout fishing on a little-known stream south and west of De Ruyter, New York. It was a fine, clear stream, but difficult to fish due to dense outcroppings of bushes in some areas and long stretches of open water in others that were hard to get to without being seen. There were all sorts of strange contraptions, sticks from trees and bits of board nailed and wired together in a fantastic array. I cannot describe them adequately, so we'll have to draw pictures. Sometimes these structures were stuck into a pile of stones or a stone wall. Sometimes even they were nailed to trees. One I remember could have been a child's treehouse. It had a definitive third dimension, except it was so abstract and useless. It was just a conglomeration of sticks and wire woven into a fabric of tree branches. Roughly 2 miles away from my starting point, I came upon the ruins of a house." And that was Lee Brown Coy, Scrying Stones in Dolmen.
If folks are good at editing, you might want to take this little conversation and cut it out and stick it back in the actual episode. Little research and we should have been able to pick up on that. But thanks, folks, for writing in and adding the detail on the show notes, because if people listen, they can then go down and get those little factoids.
Yeah.
So appreciate it. Now we're on to the Velts, the Ray Bradbury story. Ryan T. Reichart writes, "What I find interesting rereading the story recently and also picking and choosing some stories out of my Bradbury collection is this theme of the cold cruelty of children. This story, Zero Hour, and All Summer in a Day all showcase the seeming willingness of children to effortlessly do evil acts. As an adult, this is particularly terrifying because I now have children and am witness to the tiny acts of cruelty they enact on one another with innocent glee, tormenting one another just for the enjoyment or to get a reaction. Normally it's very harmless, but it makes you wonder what they would do to one another, or you as the parent, as in the case of Zero Hour and the Velt, if they were allowed to act on these impulses with impunity, or more frighteningly, with the negative outside influence of some other, be it technology or what have you. They seem to go from being sweet, innocent little things who want and express love and affection to behaving in these cruel ways, seemingly at the flick of a switch. I'll be sleeping with my bedroom door locked tonight, thanks to this." Yeah, I mean, kids have not really... Empathy is something that needs to be developed. There's a little bit of it that you're born with, but we have to make a lot of mistakes, and that is frightening. Like that Twilight Zone with the omnipotent kid, or read Lord of the Flies. It's all in there.
Oh, you know, I just read a really interesting article, which maybe I can remember to link to in the show notes, about the real-life Lord of the Flies, where some kids in Australia, or was it New Zealand? Don't remember exactly. This happened in the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. About seven kids got on a boat and they ended up getting stuck out at sea. They crash landed on an island and they were there for a year and a half. They were presumed dead. They had funerals for all these kids. And then somebody saw them going by. Total opposite Lord of the Flies. They all just got their acts together, figured out how to survive and watched out for each other.
Really?
Yeah.
You said that was in the 60s?
I think it was in the 60s or the late 60s, early 70s, I think.
But post Gilligan's Island.
Post Gilligan's Island? Yeah, I guess it would be.
Because I think that probably the biggest benefit of that show is it models good shipwreck behavior.
True. Yeah.
Instead of fighting over, you can pretty much figure, I'm the professor, you're Marianne. Mm-hmm. He's the skipper.
Yeah.
And then you don't descend into chaos.
Monster Talk writes, "Okay, a few thoughts. First, the kids are named Peter and Wendy. Seriously, that has to be a Peter Pan reference, right? The name Wendy was quite uncommon until the book Peter Pan popularized it. So that implies a reference about children not wanting to grow up and to indulge their selfish piratical tendencies." Piratical?
Piratical, yes. I didn't even think about that. I think that is a reference to Peter Pan. And I didn't know that that was an uncommon name before. My mother's name is Wendy.
Mm-hmm.
I've never read Peter Pan. It always seemed... I saw the cartoon actually only recently, and the play was really neat. I went to go see that a couple years ago. The kids' play where they get you to clap for Tinkerbell and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That was neat. But in general, I didn't really get Peter Pan ever. I didn't want to be a kid forever. Being a kid was miserable.
Yeah.
Like, get me out of this.
Yeah. Monster Talk goes on to say, "Second, this recalls a lengthy argument I and my cousin got into in high school. I argued that Bradbury was my favorite sci-fi writer. She argued that he's disqualified from the category because all of his sci-fi is fantasy." This is now the Star Wars versus Star Trek battle zone, I guess. After about 6 years, I decided she was right. I reread a bunch of of both, and then cogitated on it and conveyed my conversation at a family reunion. Decades later, it still seems right.
Yeah, I think there's points to be made about, though. I would say, and we talked a lot in that episode about his predictions on technology, which is not really fantasy, but bigger themes in the way he tells stories. Yeah, he's a magical writer. He doesn't really care whether something's possible or not, as long as it tells a good story. But he is using some futurism for the details, so...
Yes, Monster Truck goes on to say, third, I agree that the magical thing we're supposed to allow in this story isn't the tech, it's the blurring of the lines between the technical and the magical. I do like Chris's thought-provoking idea that the parents might not exist at all, but that is probably a bridge too far using a strictly textual analysis, since nothing implies in the story that the parents, ostensibly the protagonist, right, are not actually real people within the story. But I think Bradbury likes the emotional punch and the horror more than he cares about the plausible mechanism by which things in the walls could come and eat the parents. There is an interesting reversal of the main childhood fear of the dark and the unknown thing in the closet, though, isn't there? In the closet, the imagination creates unknown dread and horror. Here, the parents are consumed in brightest day by quite speakable horrors, which are crisp and clear and deadly. The thing they can't see isn't the virtual turned-on real lions, but the real but ignored kids.
Tara Murphy writes, poor sweet Chris. His science brain always has such a hard time with Bradbury.
It's true.
You need to stop struggling, Chris. Bradbury is always one-third reality, one-third magic, and one-third dream state. Also, little kids are tiny selfish monsters with no empathy unless it is based on Ray's own childhood. Then it is a golden, endless dream. That's so funny.
Oh,
I remember my grandmother gave me a copy of Dandelion Wine. The Ray Bradbury book. And I opened it up. There were no laser guns. It was just like sweet, sweet Illinois summertime. The breeze. I was like, this isn't what Illinois is like. Toss. There's no robots in that. There's no toilets in the front yard. The comment goes on to say, Ray just doesn't do hard sci-fi. Maybe you guys should get drunk for the next Bradbury story. Does that make it hard sci-fi if you're drunk while you're reading it? I also love that Chad brought up The Murderer. I read it as a kid in the 80s and reread it a few years ago. It was astonishingly prescient. I know I wish I had the willpower to murder my phone. Clayton Patterson writes, Chad, quit everything and become an ornithologist. That bird call stirred something within myself as well as the geese I was chasing off my fence. You know, actually, when I called Wings air feet in that Manimal episode, it really caught on in the orny scene.
Yeah.
The orny scene is what ornithologists call their little group where they hang out.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Michael Littlefield writes, the children telling McLean they'll be here directly when he asked them about where their parents are made me think that perhaps the parents in the story weren't the real parents, but rather holographic characters created as means for the children to take out their pent-up anger at having parents who are out of touch with their children. The bloodied scarf and the chewed-up wallet and blood and the screams could be mere projections brought on by the children's imagination. In the meantime, the actual parents are packing up for the vacation, unaware that their children are having another set of holographic visions of them being slaughtered by lions. This is just a theory, but that's what I love about Ray Bradbury's story. They have many different levels that you could read them on.
Yeah. I'm going to try that out. If I'm worried they don't like me or something, I'm going to go, hey, I'm a hologram of Chad. He sent me ahead of time so you could just get out your negative feelings, take out your pent-up anger, and then they'll go, ah, I hate you so much. You're so stupid. I'll go, stop. It's really me. Tricked you. Now I know.
Oh, boy.
So thanks, Michael. I'm going to try that out.
Next up is The Invaders.
The Invaders. Pete Williams writes, cranky old man Chad sounds a lot like the guy who had a one-night stand with a swamp witch a while back. Guilty. Daniel Carroll writes, Chad's comment about people who tell you about something they're going to do, but then never do it. It's actually a well-known psychological effect. Simply telling someone your idea releases the same hormones as if you had already done it. So once you've gotten that hit, the drive to follow through diminishes. It's true that it's better off as a rule telling people about things you've already done than making them a party to your plans. People get sick of it, you know? There is a little TED talk that he linked out to that's really interesting about this specific psychological phenomena. That I watched. So, yeah, thanks for forwarding that.
It makes perfect sense. I get it.
It does, yeah.
The Last Human at Innsmouth writes, after listening to this podcast all day, every day at work since the beginning of February, I have to say the real horror is being completely caught up on episodes. Oh, sorry. I even upped my subscription to get more bonus content. Great job, you guys. And I can't wait to hear the next one. On to Voluminous.
All right. That's a good choice. Thanks for listening, man. Glad to have you on board. Manimal Episode 2, Illusion. Monster Talk writes, damn, so excited you guys have started this sub-podcast, which I'm calling Fanimal, Manimal Fancast. Looking forward to hearing more about the whole Manimal family. Faminally? Faminally? Seriously, if you do all the episodes, I'd be delighted. I'm still haunted by the trauma of missing literally every episode of this show because I was in band.
Aww.
Well, actually, I'd like to congratulate your band director because people maybe didn't understand at the time, but he or she was protecting you and your classmates, I think. Looked at the TV guide schedule and said, I'm pulling him in on that hour that Manimal's on. Our friend KJ Middlebrooks, he's read for the show. He had a friend who was actually a dancer in Barry Manilow's show in Vegas.
Oh, right, yeah.
And you threw me a very nice bachelor party in Vegas back when I was getting married. KJ went to the bachelor party, but he had to take off at one point to go see his friend in the Barry Manilow show, which he had tickets to. And then he came back around and hooked up with us. And I said, well, how did it go? Did you like the show? And he just shrugged and said, I'm a fan of Low.
Yes.
Yeah, I think if it works for Manilow, it should work for Manimal.
Of course. Alan Ricks writes, this is one of your best bonus episodes ever. Never stop the batshit 80s TV show train. This could be its own podcast. Joel Hacker writes, no such thing as too much Manimal content. I watched these with my grandfather as a kid. Good, if sometimes weird memories. Same grandfather that got me hyped as a child for the premiere of Star Trek The Next Generation and used to buy me sci-fi fantasy, poetry, and gaming books.
And then Joel adds, I'm not possessed by my grandfather. What a silly assertion. This post is about Manimal.
Man, you had a cool grandfather. Jeez.
Yeah, that's really cool. My grandpa never showed me Manimal.
No.
Or love.
My grandfather always yelled about me and my brother wrestling.
Good, that he wanted to see it, or that you were doing
it. No, knock
it
off, kids. You're going to break something or hurt yourselves.
I like the other version where he's like, put those books down and wrestle. What kind of grandkids am I raising?
But my other grandfather taught me some woodworking.
Oh, that's pretty good.
So that's pretty good.
I only, my dad's dad was dead before I was born, so I only got the one. That's important information.
Good. Now on to a matter of fact. Sanjay Matthew writes, woo, Kipling. As an ethnic Indian, I find his racial views problematic, but he's a fascinating writer nonetheless, with a wonderful way with words. Upon rereading the story, there's something very interesting to be said about Kipling's treatment of the British newspapers and constructed British nationalist reality. But I've had a few beers and can't... But I've had a few beers and can't concretize it.
Fair enough. I've had no beers and I probably wouldn't understand it.
No.
Shoggoth Lord writes, on the British Empire just moving slavery around under a different name, it's depressing that that's just the way it happened. Here in the States, slavery was only made illegal for those not convicted of a crime, meaning prisoners could still be used as a source of free labor, as they are to this day.
Yep.
Couple that with rampant over-policing and criminalizing of black and brown people, and it's SSDD. Yeah, I agree, the world sucks.
Philip Cohen writes, I should maybe be more interested in this story than I am, given that I teach journalism, but I find it rather anticlimactic. Besides, it's not convincing that the whole ship's crew and passengers saw this thing and couldn't convince an editor that they all at least claimed it was true. Oh, yeah, I could see that. Hmm. An artist's sketch of the beast and a headline such as, From the Depths of the Sea? Question mark. Then a subheading, the whole crew and passengers of a steamer swear blind they spotted this creature. I think Kipling is wasting the, and you never read it in the papers because no one would believe it, ending on a less than involving tale. On a positive note, I take it the fiction the main protagonist says he will write is this story. I think it's neat because therein lies the suggestion that the story is true, or is it?
Yeah, that was the coolest bit of that. I'm going to write mine as fiction because nobody will believe it. So you go, oh, this is the piece of fiction that he wrote. Wait, so all of this actually did happen, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
I agree, though. I think that maybe it's more a comment on the business of journalism than journalism itself.
Yeah, I can see that.
I think the journalist should be interested in reporting the facts and getting them out there and not necessarily be invested in whether people even listen or buy the paper or anything like that, right? When I took my journalism 101, it was about just the facts, ma'am, get them out. So they didn't really address that because the writers in the story were already dressing the story up.
Yeah.
So it's not as if anybody would have presented an honest account. Their worst instincts were to try and sell papers. So I think it had a little bit more to do with the business of it, but I agree.
Yeah.
There was a third way they could have tried. But you know what else about this that I think, even if people did believe you, is it news really? Because the biggest problem with reporting on a sea monster is we don't know what's all down there, even now. You know, so if you see something odd come up from the ocean, it's like, yeah, all it is something we don't know what it is. It's not monstrous or an anomaly or, we just didn't know about it. So it's not news when I see some dude emerge from the subway wearing a lobster bib as pants. Because I simply haven't seen all that's on offer from the human race.
Yeah, sure.
It's surprising to me, but it's not surprising in general that this guy is out there. And I think it's similar with sea monsters.
Christine McCann writes, I like to read this in a way Kipling 100% did not intend. All these men see a second female creature and assume that it's a supportive mate. But in reality, it has mortally wounded the male creature and appears distressed because it has been fighting it to the death. But of course, the oldie-timey dudes can't see this truth because once they coded the creature as female, they can't see her as dominant or violent, only as a secondary submissive helpmeet. One also wonders how these journalists so easily sex unknown sea creatures. I assume the female had long eyelashes and a bow on her head. Yes, probably.
Miss Pac-Man style.
Danielle writes, I like your version better than the original. Truly, Kipling was a feminist icon.
He was, yeah, he really was.
Stacy Schumacher writes, honestly, when I first saw the second creature referenced as female, I 100% assumed she had just wrecked the male for encroaching on her territory. Still makes the most sense to me. Humans aren't the best at interpreting real animal behavior, to say nothing of fictional creatures. And Allison Albright writes, I think this version is a lot more likely to be the accurate version, since very few animal species engage in pair bonding mating, and humans are extremely likely to view the world dimly through their own distorting cultural lens.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I think even in the episode, we just let it fly, but it's totally, or maybe we did mention it. I mean, I thought the same thing. Maybe this one animal just totally destroyed the other animal.
Yeah. Like
they were coming in at the end of a fight.
Yeah.
But I think that shows you how, to these writers, they were already constructing a narrative while they were still witnessing the event.
Yeah.
They didn't dispassionately examine it afterward. And, you know, we've had a lot of flies coming into the apartment this summer, and you got to kill them fast because otherwise you'll lose track of them. So I run across the room and I smack them. And usually what happens is the body goes flying somewhere. So then I spend the next half hour trying to find this fly body. If you came in and just saw that behavior, you might think I was... And you didn't, you know, if you didn't understand our species, you might look at how sad that guy is looking around for the fly that he lost, you know? No, I want to find its little twitching body so I can finish the job, you know? And this animal could very well have been doing the same thing.
Sure thing.
Yeah.
And lastly, Phil Esterbrook writes, after all these years, I still enjoy getting those little glimpses into the inner workings of Chris and Chad. This episode was all Chris. When Chad mentioned the monster might be similar to the Kraken in Clash of the Titans, Chris breathlessly exclaimed, oh yeah, I like that. And then I think I almost heard him moistening his lips.
Whoa. But I'm curious, what is the little glimpse into the inner workings that you got? I don't think it's a surprise that you like Clash of the Titans or the Kraken. No. So no. I think something else is being implied here, like maybe, you know, that's what you're into.
Like it's a sexual fetish.
Maybe. Because it says a little glimpse into the inner working.
I hadn't thought about that before, but now that you say it, I haven't watched Clash of the Titans in maybe 15, 20 years, honestly.
Sure.
If I did watch it, maybe I would find it erotic. I think I was a bit titillated by the topless Medusa.
Oh, we've talked about that before.
Okay, it was
because when we were little watching that movie, I mean, you just have a sexual reaction to seeing a naked woman. But when it's Medusa, it makes you feel very weird. So that was,
I need to revisit it. I have not seen it since I was
I think it's on Netflix now, actually.
I'm going to check it out.
It up recently. The Kraken, you know, I think Kraken is definitely male. Comes up out of the water. There's nothing real sexual about the Kraken until that third arm busts out, because you don't know it's coming. And then, boom, third arm. So that might be...
Well, it's got four arms altogether.
It has four arms? Not the Kraken in the movie. It's got two arms. It looks like it's a humanoid giant sea monster with just kind of a creature-y kind of face. And then a third arm busts out, but it's like on his... It's jointed with another arm. Oh, maybe it does have four arms.
It has four, because there was a
toy. You know, guys, this is obviously something that we can't solve on our own. We're going to have to leave this to the listeners. Go watch Clash of the Titans. Get your abacus out. And if you get, and let us know whether the Kraken has three arms or four arms. I hate giving out homework, but, you know, everybody's got to be doing school at home right now. So go do a little research. Folks, thanks so much for tuning in. That was our comments show for July. We're going to be back at you with more fun stuff next month. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast Comment Show.
Exclusively on Patreon. Ooh.